This is WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We're going to talk air quality and climate change this hour. The American Lung Association releases a report card each year, and for 2014, Philadelphia and its suburban counties scored an F for ozone pollution. Joining me is Joe Minot. He's Executive Director of the Clean Air Council here in Philadelphia. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
I want to start with I think we should go through a couple of terms, because we will get into, you know, some science here this hour, and I just want to make sure that we all understand what we're talking about. We're gonna hear the term ozone pollution or ozone quite a bit. Describe to me what that is. That's also, I guess, some people just call it smog.
Yes, so it's commonly referred to as smog, and it is probably the most common pollutant. Sort of the report said, I think about 50% of Americans live in areas that do not attain the federal health standards for air quality. Ozone is probably the most common of the pollutants. It's a poisonous form of oxygen. Really, it attacks the lungs and exacerbates pre-existing lung disease, and it's fairly widespread.
And how does it form?
Well, that's the tricky part, and I'm not a scientist, but it's not emitted. So, like a lot of the pollutants that we're going to be talking about today are emitted directly into the environment, and ozone isn't. Ozone is a photochemical reaction that takes volatile organic compounds and oxides of nitrogen that mix in sunlight and heat and cause this chemical reaction that causes this poisonous form of oxygen that you breathe in. And there is ozone, as you know, high up in the atmosphere, or stratosphere, I guess it is, that is good ozone that protects us from ultraviolet rays and prevents us from getting cancer. This is bad ozone because it's ground level and we're breathing it in deep.
Okay. And so essentially fossil fuels get burned in an engine or something like that. They put off pollutants, and then that reacts with the sun and you get ozone in there, kind of in that process, to probably simplify it a lot.
But. Right. No, that's exactly right. So things like power plants, cars, almost anything that burns emits both carbon and oxides of nitrogen. The oxides of nitrogen travel great distances, and the volatile organic compounds are more local and they mix together, and you see it go right up I-95 corridor. So it's not a lot of people like to think, well, Philadelphia is the problem. Well, Philadelphia isn't the problem. It's the whole region, and it goes right up the I-95 corridor.
So let's talk about another term, particulate pollution. What is that?
That's frankly the one that scares me the most, and it is really small solids and liquids that are so small that your body's defense system can't prevent them from going deep into the lungs, and often other pollutants sort of attach to them and also breathe deep into the lungs. And it's probably the pollutant that has, I think, the most immediate and long-term health impacts on people.
So it can bring those nasty things into your body, essentially.
And deep into the lungs, so that there's no way that you can sort of cough it out or what have you.
And for most of us, I think we might identify, like if you're behind a truck or a bus or something and you see a big belch of black smoke, could that be particulate pollution?
Well, yes and no. Yes, it is, in that there's particulates in there. In fact, diesel particulates are particularly dangerous. But there's also a lot of other stuff, which is what you see. Most fine particulates you can't really see.
Okay. And we want to talk about those two things, because this American Lung Association report that came out not too long ago measures and issues a report card on both of those things, ozone pollution and particulate pollution. And the report says that across the country, generally, the air is getting healthier. That's a long-term trend, thanks to things like the Clean Air Act. Is there anything? What? Why is the air sort of generally getting better or cleaner? What's happening there?
Well, the Clean Air Act was passed in the 1970s, and is probably one of the nation's most effective public health laws. It has dramatically reduced our exposure to air pollution. What we've also found, though, is as we study it, that the levels that we set, you know, that we thought were at one point were safe, are not safe. And so we keep tightening the standard, which of course drives industry crazy, but it in fact is right from a public health point of view. And so overall air quality is getting a lot better, but that doesn't mean that we still don't have a long ways to go.
Okay, so that's across the country.
Yeah.
Let's focus a little bit more on Philadelphia and the surrounding area specifically. What's the situation like here?
So the Philadelphia area, and you're right to call it the Philadelphia area as opposed to just Philadelphia, composes southern New Jersey, southeastern Pennsylvania, and actually Delaware, and a portion of Maryland also is part of sort of what we call the Delaware Valley. That's the airshed. And we're struggling. We struggle to meet the federal health standards for ozone smog and for particulate. Part of the problem from a particulate point of view is that there's this transport issue, which is power plants that are upwind of us send a lot of their, nasty stuff into the area. And recently, there's a good court decision that I think we'll be talking about later that sort of addresses that.
There is. We are going to talk about that a little bit more later. But when I was looking through the different grades, and I focus specifically on Philadelphia and the counties in Pennsylvania and New Jersey around there, and on high ozone days, the report card for that, all Fs, pretty much across the board. Particulate pollution, a little more varied there.
Right. So the first thing to realize is that the data, I believe, is 2012 data, so it's not even sort of last year. A lot of these pollutants, both particulate and ozone, are sensitive to atmospheric changes, so to the weather, essentially. And so you're going to sort of see variations year to year, depending on how hot and sunny it is, what kind of air inversions we have. So I think that it's important to realize that we have a failing grade and sort of move forward, but I wouldn't get obsessed by that because it is going to change year to year.
And like 2012 was I think it was 2012 that was a pretty hot year, and things look bad there because if ozone requires that sort of first burning the fossil fuel and then the reaction of the sun with the output, then a hot year or a sunny year is going to be more of a problem.
Right, and so I did sort of glanced at, or I should say someone from my office was nice enough to take a look at the data for 2013, and their ozone is overall better in the region, but that has more to do with weather than anything else.
And so then on those days where things get bad, can there be certain areas in a region that are worse than others, or is it just kind of the region in general?
I think for particulate and for ozone, it's really more helpful to think of it as a regional issue. We can certainly talk about sort of localized air pollution issues, but for the National Ambient Air Quality Standards, the federal health standards, it's really a regional issue.
And I've heard about something called the heat island effect. What is that?
Well, that is much more of an urban issue, which is that we get these incredibly hot summer days now, mostly due to climate change, and you don't get the cool down at night that you should get that gives us the relief. So that people in urban areas where there's a lot of concrete, the temperature is a lot higher, and that is a public health threat. It's a serious public health threat for the elderly or people with pre-existing health conditions.
We are talking with Joe Minot. He's the Executive Director of the Clean Air Council located here in Philadelphia. If you want to join the conversation, the telephone number is 1-888-477-9499. The email is radiotimes@whyy.org. And you mentioned climate change a few minutes ago. How does if heat makes a difference in how much ozone pollution there is, how is climate change going to affect all of this, is it affecting all of this?
Well, the third climate assessment has been released fairly recently, and I think we're going to have a speaker that may talk more professionally about that than I do. But it what was interesting to me is it really shows that climate change is already having an impact on the Philadelphia area. And what we're seeing is a number of things. We're seeing more serious flooding. We're seeing more serious rain. We're seeing much more serious heat. That is, the number of days that are above 100 degrees and aren't cooling down at night. Because that's the it's bad enough when it's hot during the day, but when it doesn't cool down at night is when you start having some more serious health effects. And we're starting to see an increase in vector-borne diseases. That is, from ticks and mosquitoes. So climate change is here, and the question is, what are we going to do about it?
I noticed in looking at that American Lung Association report that there were some counties where there was no grade because there were no monitors there to monitor the air. Are there enough monitors around to keep track of what's going on?
Well, that's a very good question, and the answer is it depends what you're looking for. So if you're looking for sort of regional air pollutants, that is ozone and particulates, the answer is probably yes, you know, because we just need to have sort of the big view. If you're looking for what's happening in a very specific area in terms of pollution, no, then we're clearly not doing enough monitoring.
And you've done some work on that, right?
We've done some. So we have tried to look at what the impact is of various pollutants in low-income communities in particular, because those are the neighborhoods that are most burdened by pollution. Not only the pollution that all of us are impacted by, that is the ozone and the particulate, but also what's coming into their neighborhoods from the refinery that they live next to, or the auto body shop that's right next door, or the fact that they live next to a major highway. And we have done some very sort of handheld type monitoring in areas of the Northeast, and found in fact that for particulate levels that they were substantially higher in those neighborhoods.
So if you're someone who already has breathing problems and you're especially susceptible to these days that we're talking about, how do you keep track of when those days are coming, and what do you do?
Well, so I guess I have two answers to that. One is your body usually tells you. So I have a lung disease, and I can know on high ozone days. No one has to tell me it's a high ozone day. I know it. I feel it. I have problems breathing. But there is a pretty good system of red, orange, and what have you that many radio and TV stations sort of will predict what the air quality is going to be the next day, and you just have to pay really attention to that. And if it's a really hot day, the chances are the pollution is going to be high too.
We just have a little bit of time here before we go to a break, but tell me what that's like. I mean, how do you know? Is it just how does that feel to you when the ozone levels are high?
It feels it's hard to get a good deep breath. So the disease I have is sarcoidosis. It's an immune disorder, and I'm usually fine, but when the air quality is bad, it's hard to get a good deep breath. And so if you're asthmatic or you have OCPD, I mean, there's a lot of people that are in the same boat as I am. And then the other people worried about are the people that have to work outside during high ozone days, for instance, because they're just doing their lungs harm.
And you just have to stay inside more?
So if you stay inside, take it easy, and stay with air conditioning, then you're in better shape.
Right. We're talking with Joe Minot. He is the executive director of the Clean Air Council here in Philadelphia. And you can join the conversation. We're going to have another guest in just a minute here. The phone number is 1-888-477-9499. The email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And if you want to send a tweet, you can send it to me at Jeff Brady NPR. We'll be back in a minute.
Thomas Jefferson University Hospital is proud to support WHYY. With a hospital dedicated just to neuroscience, Jefferson treats complex disorders of the brain and spine with advanced technologies and research. Jefferson's multidisciplinary team of neurology specialists devises individual treatment plans for patients with everything from aneurysm to epilepsy. Thomas Jefferson University Hospital. To make an appointment or for more information, the number is 1-800-JEFF-NOW or online at jefferson.edu.
Next time on The Pulse, a look at waiting at doctor's offices.
It was a long wait time, you know.
Only 5 minutes behind schedule.
Waiting in laboratories.
To actually answer the question, we could sit around and wait for 10 years.
At a banana warehouse.
I may expect them to ripen one way, and they are very stubborn and don't ripen that way. So, yes, I have to wait for them.
You're going to wait with us tomorrow morning at 9 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. In the new film Words and Pictures, Clive Owen stars as a prep school English teacher who uses an unusual challenge to try to save his job.
You pick a subject, paint a picture, we print it in the issue. I write 1,000 words on the same subject. We have an assembly. Words versus pictures, which is worth more?
Clive Owen, next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about air pollution this hour, and we are going to bring a guest in with us. Jody Freeman is director of the Harvard Law School Environmental Law and Policy Program and a former counselor for energy and climate change in the Obama White House. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Hey, good morning. So the Obama administration, at least on the legal front, has been on a little bit of a roll lately, winning three big court decisions that deal with regulating air pollution. Maybe you can help us kind of run through those court decisions and understand what's been decided here recently.
Let's start
with what you have to say about the court decisions and see if we can kind of get a better idea.
Well, you're right that EPA and the administration has really been on a roll. If you were keeping score here, you'd say that they were really out ahead with three big wins, as you mentioned. The one that's the real recent blockbuster is the one that Joe mentioned, which is a case called Homer, EME versus Homer, in which the Supreme Court just recently upheld the EPA's rule that tries to deal with this cross-state pollution problem. So it upheld this transport rule that had been struck down by the lower court, by the D.C. Circuit. That's a blockbuster win for EPA because it really creates a very secure legal foundation for EPA to go ahead and implement a system that reduces the pollution that blows across these state lines, as you've been talking about. And EPA's approach is to try to tackle this problem by going after the cheapest cuts they can, the cheapest emission reductions in the places where they really haven't spent a lot of money on pollution control. So it's one of those rules that's trying to achieve a big health benefit for a fairly low cost, and the court just upheld the approach, so it's a really big win for the agency.
And I want to talk more about that in a minute, but I want to make sure we talk about all three of these things, these decisions first off. So there was another one having to do with standards for fine particulate matter or soot?
Yes. So this month, the D.C. Circuit, not the Supreme Court, but the court just below, the appellate court, did uphold a tighter standard for the pollutant Joe was talking about, particulate matter, which you and I think of as soot. And that, again, is a big win because it allows the agency to tighten up the requirements across the country for the sources that produce that particulate matter, sources like coal plants, refineries, and even cars and trucks. So that, again, reinforced EPA's authority to over time tighten up these standards to respond to new public health data.
And then back in mid-April, I think the third one we're talking about here had to do with regulating things like mercury and arsenic having to do with coal plants?
Right. That's the air toxics rule that people talk about. And again, the D.C. Circuit here, the court just below the Supreme Court, upheld EPA's new rule regulating all the toxics you just mentioned. And all of this taken together is significant because these rules overlap to some extent. They really address the pollution coming out of the very big sources like the coal-fired power plants. And if you take them all together, what you're really doing is what you see is a trend toward requiring at least some minimal and then updated controls on sources like coal-fired power plants. They have really significant health benefits across the country. And in places like Pennsylvania, the health benefits are very important, and they greatly outweigh the cost.
And that's Jody Freeman. She's director of the Harvard Law School Environmental Law and Policy Program. We're talking about air pollution this hour. We also have in the studio Joe Minot. He's the executive director of the Clean Air Council located here in Philadelphia. And you just sort of raised your hand to say that there's something that you wanted to interject here, Joe.
Right. So I think Jody explained the results of the three cases really well. And in terms of the impact on Philadelphia, the one thing that I would like to say is that new particulate standard is going to have a tremendous impact. And And one of the things that they require now is much better monitoring next to highways, which is going to have a profound impact, I think, when we find the results on low-income communities. And the good neighbor rule that Jody talked about, too, is going to substantially reduce the amount of particulate pollution that comes in from upwind states. So those are both really important for Philadelphia area.
Okay. And now, Jody, these were all cases where the administration had made rules, then opponents challenged them, and then a court upheld them. What's going on here?
Well, I think EPA is pretty pleased right now because it's implementing the Clean Air Act. Joe mentioned it was passed in 1970, and the agency is implementing a law that has not been updated since 1990. But, you know, air pollution science and our understanding of its health impacts has greatly improved since 1990, and Congress has really not done much. Congress hasn't updated the law to deal with those problems. It hasn't updated the law to try to deal with this terribly persistent cross-state pollution problem where polluted air migrates from state to state in sometimes unpredictable patterns, and Congress hasn't dealt with climate change. So here's EPA dealing with a 40-year-old statute, and it's trying to adapt it and deal with the most recent science and the most recent data, and it's going into the courts defending its rules, and it seems to be winning. As Joe just mentioned, the agency was implementing what's known popularly as a good neighbor provision in the law, and the provision basically says that when states file plans that explain how they're going to meet air pollution standards, those plans have to include provisions that will prevent them from emitting pollution that will lead to other states having problems meeting air pollution standards themselves. And that's called the good neighbor provision. So you're supposed to make sure your state doesn't produce pollution that migrates and interferes with other states. And EPA has been trying to deal with this problem for, you know, 25 years, and has been battling challenges for at least 15 years in the courts over its rules, and finally the Supreme Court has spoken. So it's a very significant win. It will allow the states to engage in trading programs that are very cost-effective to reduce these pollutants, and it finally settles an issue that's been moving through the courts all this time.
I want to talk a little bit more about the politics, because I think this is a really important point, and I'm not sure that it's a little hard to grasp. It took me some time kind of reading through stuff to understand exactly what was going on. But, you know, an agency can't just go out and start passing rules. They have to base those rules on a law. So the EPA has to go, can identify a problem out in the world like climate change, and then there has to be a law that they rely on to implement rules. In this case, that's the Clean Air Act. But the Clean Air Act was never written. We weren't really thinking about climate change when it was written, right?
Right. You got it exactly right. What happens over time is these laws age, and Congress is addressing a problem at a particular moment, but it doesn't always deal in detail with the latest science, and it can't anticipate future events. So agencies are dealing with the provisions as they're written by Congress, but agencies have some latitude to interpret those provisions when they are ambiguous, you know, when they're unclear, when they're vague. Agencies, by law, are entitled to interpret them as long as the interpretation is reasonable. And so in this case, they took language in the good neighbor provision that says, you know, you can't significantly contribute to another state's air pollution problem. And they said, you know, the way we approach that, what a significant contribution is we will tell every state that emits over a minimum percentage of pollution that contributes to another state's problem, we will start looking at how much control we can get using cost-effective technology, and we'll then calculate a budget for each state based on these cost-effective controls. So what EPA did is they said, look, we think this provision gives us some flexibility. We're going to come up with what we think is a sensible rule to address cross-state spillovers, and we're going to do it in a cost-effective way. And the Supreme Court said, yep, that makes sense. That's within the law, and it's a reasonable interpretation of the provision that Congress wrote. What's really significant here that some listeners may not be aware of is how the votes came out in this case. 6-2, this wasn't a close decision. It was a pretty overwhelming decision. And two of the justices in the majority who voted EPA's way were the Chief Justice, John Roberts, and, of course, swing Justice Kennedy. That's significant because we are going to see some new cases coming under the Clean Air Act to deal with climate change. And if those two justices wind up similarly on EPA's side, we'll continue to see the agency be given some flexibility to deal with climate change as well.
So you have some praise for the EPA, but do you feel like the larger issues that we're facing around climate change are not being addressed, even with these victories?
Yes, I think you know it's quite plain that the agency is struggling with a statute, as you mentioned, that was not perfectly designed to deal with climate change. It can deal with climate change. It's a flexible enough law. But the very best way would be for Congress to finally make a decision that it needs to address this problem and pass a statute that specifically focuses on controlling carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in a cost-efficient way. That would be the cleanest. It would be the most efficient. But Congress cannot seem to get motivated to deal with it. And so really what you're witnessing is the backup plan. The Obama administration has said if Congress won't deal with the problem, then our agencies, with the powers we already have on the books, are going to do what we can to start making a dent in the problem.
So let's talk about what's going to be happening. I think we're going to start seeing this in our newspaper headlines a little bit more often in the next month. What's going on next here?
Well, I would be on the lookout for two things. First of all, Monday, June 2nd, EPA is going to be releasing its much-awaited power plant rule, which will address greenhouse gas pollution, CO2, coming from the existing stock of power plants around the country, which are responsible for a disproportionate amount of climate pollution. And everyone's waiting for that rule because there's really never been any way to get at that existing older stock of coal-fired power plants. So people are watching for that rule. EPA has signaled that it's going to be quite forward-leaning. It's going to try to impose controls on those old dirty power plants. But it also has said it's going to do it in a cost-efficient and flexible way so that those plants might be able to invest in energy efficiency, let's say, that will go on to their ledger. If they invest in energy efficiency, then they can take credit for those reductions. So EPA is going to be putting in place a system that it hopes will very cost-effectively control greenhouse gas pollution from the power sector. The other thing to look for is another Supreme Court decision. We are still waiting on a case that challenges EPA's authority to set standards for these coal-fired power plants and other sources that are large sources of greenhouse gas pollution. This is an important case because it was a challenge to the first set of rules coming out of EPA following its historic standards for cars. EPA set some standards for stationary sources that produce greenhouse gases, and that case has to be decided before the end of June, so we're waiting and watching to see if EPA's track record so far in air pollution cases carries over and it wins this challenge to its greenhouse gas rules.
You're listening to Radio Times. We're talking with Jody Freeman, the director of the Harvard Law School Environmental Law and Policy Program. We have just a few minutes left with her and also with Joe Minot. He is the executive director of the Clean Air Council located here in Philadelphia. If you want to jump into the conversation, should do it pretty quickly here. The phone number is 1-888-477-9499. And Jody talked about those rules for power plants are going to be coming out here fairly soon. As someone who works on issues here in Philadelphia, what are you going to be looking for in those rules? What do you hope to see?
Well, Jody explained it really, really well. And what's going to be permitted in terms of dealing with carbon emissions from existing power plants, not new ones. For the new ones, the EPA will have will say what's going to be, you know, the technology. But for existing ones, the states have a much larger role to play. And so there's a really great opportunity for sort of Pennsylvania to sort of look at how to promote alternative energy and energy efficiency, as part of the package to reduce carbon emissions. My guess is that Pennsylvania will not move in that direction. Historically, they've been very protective of the coal industry, but this is a unique opportunity, and we'll see what happens.
That idea of moving toward renewable energy, I mean, it's really hard to find people who disagree with that. But I mean, all of these things, climate change, moving towards renewable energy. One thing we haven't talked about here is money, and money plays a role in these discussions.
Yeah, money plays a very important role, and one of the things that we need to keep in mind is that if you don't control, if you sort of allow the coal industry to sort of continue doing what it's been doing, then there's a cost that's paid that's picked up by taxpayers. There's a cost to harm the environment. There's cost to healthcare costs. So what we're doing now is, and the EPA has been really good at quantifying the sort of financial benefits of these rules. Yes, it's going to be somewhat painful for the operators of these coal burning power plants, but the benefit to society is much greater than that.
And also, go ahead.
On that point, I think it's very important. There are a few points about cost that people overlook. This law, Joe mentioned at the top of the conversation, this law, the Clean Air Act, is always viewed as one of the most expensive statutes because the rules have been the most expensive rules in the entire federal regulatory structure. They are the most expensive rules, but what people overlook is they are also calculated to be the most beneficial rules in terms of health care costs saved, morbidity and mortality avoided. So they have turned out to be not just the most costly, but the most beneficial rules we've ever seen. And I think people sometimes overlook that. The other thing is, when you talk about energy costs, we have seen a dramatic drop in natural gas prices over the last several years. And what that means is the market has shifted to natural gas over coal because it's now the cheaper fuel. It happens also to be the cleaner fuel. It's cleaner by 50% in terms of greenhouse gas pollution, and it's much cleaner, Joe will tell you, in terms of its public health impacts, in terms of just traditional pollutants. So this shift is really about cost, but it's saving people money.
I want to try to squeeze a quick call in here. We have Rodney calling from West Philadelphia. Rodney, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, I'll make it quick.
Thank you.
One question is about mitigating the problems with pollution, and second, if I can find out in my area what the conditions are. One, I commute on a bike daily in heavy-duty traffic, and I'm wondering, should I wear a respirator? And two, where I live is about 10,000 cars a day. I live 100 yards from the Northeast Corridor train tracks, and my windowsills are full of soot, black, every week, and I wonder, should I close everything and use this?
Okay, we're going to have to send that question to Joe here. Can you help him out?
Yeah, there's no doubt that in an urban area like Philadelphia, cars and diesel trucks are the single largest source of pollution. There's no good way of getting around that. It just simply we need to have better, you know, cleaner fuels and cleaner engines for those trucks.
All right, that is Joe Minot. He is the executive director of the Clean Air Council located here in Philadelphia. We're talking about air pollution this hour. Also on the phone, Jody Freeman, the director of the Harvard Law School Environmental Law and Policy Program and a former counselor for energy and climate change in the Obama White House. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to have writer Michael Liminick. He will join us to discuss the most recent national climate assessment, and we'll take more of your calls. If you'd like to learn a little bit more about what that assessment said, if you have questions about it was in the news recently, call us 1-888-477-9499 or email radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet me at Jeff Brady NPR. We'll be back in a minute.
The Friends Schools of Bucks County are committed to challenging minds and nurturing spirits to prepare students for life. Providing independent education from preschool through 12th grade, the Friends Schools of Bucks County include United Friends, Newtown Friends, Buckingham Friends, and the George School. Guided by Quaker values, these schools provide a core curriculum while fostering exploration, self-discipline, creativity, and a desire to learn. United Friends, Newtown Friends, Buckingham Friends, and the George School support WHYY.
As a dog handler in the Marines, Jose Armenta's job was to search for IEDs with his dog. On a mission in Afghanistan, Armenta was injured in an IED explosion. He lost both legs above the knees. The dog was not injured and was reassigned to another handler. On the next Fresh Air, Armenta talks about the mission, his slow recovery, and how he was finally reunited with his dog. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The new math on gay marriage.
It's sort of like a new group of mathematicians comes along. They say 2 plus 2 is 5. And if it's not 5 for you, then you're a mathophobe.
Can a Republican neurosurgeon named Ben Carson heal the GOP, be the new voice of conservatism, and the second African-American to make it to the White House? Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
I'm Jeff Brady. Welcome back to Radio Times. We're going to spend the rest of this hour learning more about the National Climate Assessment. The final version was released earlier this month. If you have questions, you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Also, you can send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org. Joining us is Michael Liminick. He's a writer-at-large for Climate Central, and he is also the author of 6 books. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So let's start with just a brief description of what is the National Climate Assessment that I think we probably heard a little bit about it in the news here a few weeks back.
Yeah, this is a major report issued by the U.S. government. It's something a bit like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC report that the U.N. puts out. That talks about the world's climate and the impacts on the science and so on. But this is focused just on the U.S. This is the third report. They have to issue a new one every couple of years because things keep changing. And it really details what we are seeing as a result of climate change and what we are likely to see as time goes on, as the century progresses.
And it's done because Congress said we're going to do this, right?
That's right.
Yeah. And so who puts it together?
It's a panel of scientists and policymakers organized by the government, by the White House. And so it's really a blue ribbon kind of panel, but there's something like 60 scientists, I think, that are involved. It's a very big endeavor. And it gets input from the Forest Service and the EPA and all sorts of the NOAA, all sorts of governmental bodies that keep track of this stuff.
And what does this latest assessment? It was in the news a lot for a couple of reasons. One of which is the White House promoted it. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But some of it is what was in that report. What does it say is happening already?
Well, I think what is new about this report and what is significant is that it is more able to say than previous reports have that the effects of climate change are not something that's happening in the far future or way up in the Arctic or someplace that doesn't affect your daily life. It really emphasizes the fact that climate change is now affecting the lives of people here and now all over the country.
And so in some places it said that it's getting where it's already dry, it's getting drier. In some places where it's wet, it's already getting wetter. Here in the Northeast, the report said that the frequency of significant rainstorms they're becoming more frequent.
That's right. So and this was actually a prediction that climate scientists made a decade or two ago, that this was likely to happen, but now it's happening, that areas that already get a significant amount of rainfall, like the Northeast, are getting more intense rainfalls. The rain is falling in more intense bursts. Places like the Southwest, which are desert already, are getting even drier. And California right now is experiencing one of the worst droughts in its entire history. California was already a largely dry state. It's getting drier. So those effects are being seen more and more clearly in the statistics, the weather statistics.
And I guess we get the message from this report that it's not just that, because a lot of us will say, oh, well, that was a wet year, or that was a snowy year, or that was a dry year, or that was a warm year. But the report seems to suggest that it's not really going to be like that anymore, that this is
right.
ongoing.
you know, the thing about that makes climate change sometimes hard to communicate is that it's not like one day the climate is X and then the next day it's completely transformed. It's a process where it comes on gradually, year by year. And so you can't look at one particular year and say, oh, okay, this is the year that the climate changed. It's been changing. It's going to continue changing. And it's now gotten to the point where those changes are becoming clear to everyday people. You look out the window, you look at the weather report, you look at the rainfall we're getting here and the flooding, you're looking at the major storms, and you say, wait a minute, this is different from what I remember. It's not just a wet year, it's that we've had a lot of crazy weather coming in faster and faster succession. This report says you're not just imagining it. Statistics show that it has changed, and it is going to continue to change.
We're talking with Michael Liminick. He is a writer-at-large for Climate Central and the author of six books. We're talking about the National Climate Assessment. You probably read a little bit about it or heard a little bit about it on NPR recently. And if you have questions about some of the specifics in that, he has spent a lot of time with this assessment. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499, or you can email us, radiotimes@whyy.org. And one of the things that this assessment did is kind of look at different parts of the country. We've already talked about the Northeast. I was interested in the section where it focused on Alaska. Are you familiar with this section of the assessment?
I'm somewhat familiar, yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I talked about, I guess some things that we might imagine, like glaciers and frozen ground in the state that are melting, but it paints a fairly dire picture.
Yeah, well, I mean, Alaska, we all think of as this eternally frozen place, but all over the state, the temperatures are actually warming faster than they are in almost any other part of the country, and because both the ecosystems and the people who live in Alaska have grown accustomed to the conditions that have existed there, you know, for hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years, they're having to deal with things that they've never seen before. So, as you say, the permafrost is warming, which means that buildings and infrastructure that are set on the permafrost, roads and houses and so on, runways, are not designed to survive under these conditions. So roads are collapsing, villages are sinking. It's even more worrisome than that, however, because locked up in this permafrost, this permanently frozen ground, is an enormous amount of vegetable matter from a time thousands, millions of years ago when Alaska was warmer. And as the temperatures warm, this permafrost is now melting, and the carbon in the permafrost, in this vegetable matter, is beginning to decompose. And the carbon locked up there is going to be released into the atmosphere, either in the form of carbon dioxide or methane, or both. And that is going to actually turbocharge the warming that we've already created with human emissions. So it's kind of a secondary effect that will boost the speed and destructive power of climate change.
The report also talks about the West generally, and something that I observed when I was living in Colorado and working for NPR before I relocated to Philadelphia, and there is an outbreak of something called the mountain pine beetle.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is a very significant and worrisome effect, and it's not, and it is indeed all over the West, the Northwest, different species of pine beetle live in different parts of the West, but they are alike in that they are kept under control naturally by the freezing temperatures that come over the winter. They simply can't reproduce, and they can't spread very easily. They're held back every winter by cold temperatures. It's as the winters have gotten warmer in the West, which they have, and which can be documented, these beetles have been able to thrive and multiply and increase in numbers over the winter where they couldn't before, and they're now attacking forests on the mountains, chewing into trees and killing them. And so you've got massive, massive diebacks of pine and other conifers in the West that are laying whole mountainsides bare, really.
Yeah, I can tell you it's an extraordinary sight, because you'll be driving through the Rocky Mountains and you expect to see, you know, a bunch of mountains that are rocky, but then in the areas that are a little wetter, you'll see big pine forest, you know, all green all the way up the hillside, and then you'll see one spot where a tree has died, and then over time that just spreads and spreads, and after a while you've got an entire hillside that looks sort of rust colored, because it's all the trees are dead there because of this mountain pine beetle. And it happened because the last winter wasn't cold enough to kill off the eggs that were laid there. It's pretty
extraordinary sight. This is projected to become an increasingly serious problem all across the West. And it's also the case that other kinds of pests that are held back by cold weather have their ranges limited by cold weather, including mosquitoes and other insects that carry diseases that affect humans, are projected to spread their ranges as the climate warms. So it's not just the trees that are in some danger from insects. It's also humans.
We're talking about the National Climate Assessment, and we have on the phone Michael Liminick. He is a writer-at-large for Climate Central and also the author of six books. If you'd like to join the conversation, the telephone number is 1-888-477-9499. And we have Richard on the telephone from Downington. Richard, welcome to Radio Times.
Good morning, everybody. I do a lot of work with climate issues with the Climate Reality Project, and I think the critical issue that gets very little discussion, in fact it hasn't really been brought up in this conversation yet, is the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, which is what is causing the warming. We pump 90 million tons of CO2 up there every 24 hours, and we have increased the relationship between carbon and oxygen in the atmosphere. We've increased it by 121 parts per million in just a very short time. I'd like to hear what your guest has to say about that.
Oh, well, I'm happy to talk about that. I mean, all of this stuff that we're talking about, and thank you for reminding us that this whole issue of climate change and climate change caused by humans is a result of the emissions that we've been pumping out, mostly but not entirely, by burning fossil fuels, starting with the Industrial Revolution. And as you say, the concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere have been climbing. They have now reached 400 parts per million, which is meaningless if you're not a scientist, but let's just say it's significantly higher than we've had in the atmosphere for at least 800,000 years, and probably longer than that. So by driving our cars, heating our homes, creating electricity, we have added this heat-trapping greenhouse gas to the atmosphere at unprecedented levels in human experience. And all of this stuff we're talking about, this entire climate assessment, the IPCC reports, all of this is talking about the effects of that CO2 and other gases that we have put into the atmosphere. Absolutely.
I noticed that when this report was released, the White House made sure that it got extra attention. We're talking about the National Climate Assessment here. Do you know why that is?
Well, it's because it's a real problem. It's a real and significant problem. I mean, we've known that this was a potential problem for 25 years. We've known it's a potential problem for 100 years. We've really begun talking about it in a serious way about 25 years ago, but there's been enormous political resistance to doing something about it. And I have not talked to the president, but I get a very strong sense that he takes this problem seriously and really feels an urgent need to move things forward, to take some significant action. And part of that process is letting people know, hey, this is really happening, and we can do something about it, but we've got to act quickly to avoid the worst effects. And I think there's a genuine understanding at the White House that this really is a problem. And I think the president wants us to do something about it. And he's trying to raise people's consciousness and try and get some political will behind taking action.
Well, we were talking in the previous segment about these new rules on power plants that are expected to come out here fairly soon. An assessment like this could, I assume, help build support for something like that.
I would hope so, yes. I mean, you would think it would. I mean, it is reasonable to hope, at least, that the more that people can connect their everyday experience. Again, we used to have to say, well, it's coming, and it'll be, up in the future, it's going to be a big problem, and the polar bears are unhappy. But people have a real hard time connecting with that because they've got other problems in their lives that feel more urgent.
I want to talk a little bit more about how this report came out, because I think it's interesting that the president sort of hung out with a bunch of weathermen. Tell us a little bit more about that and what you thought of that.
I thought it was great. At Climate Central, we've actually been working with TV meteorologists for a couple of years now, based on the idea that most ordinary people don't read scientific reports, and they don't read Scientific American, and they watch the local news, and they trust their local meteorologist as a person they know. That person comes into their house every evening and talks to them one-to-one, really. And the idea that people could be educated about climate change through these trusted messengers who clearly know something about weather and climate is a very powerful one. We've been working with, I think we're up to more than 100 meteorologists now, to help them deliver climate messages. The president was sending the same signal. Here are these people who come into your home, and I want them to understand, and they do understand, that climate is a real issue that you should be thinking about, along with your mortgage and your and whatever. This is happening now.
Michael Lemonick is a writer-at-large for Climate Central. He's also the author of 6 books. We've been talking about the National Climate Assessment. Thanks much for being here today.
Thanks very much for having me. Tell people to come to climatecentral.org.
You just did. I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moskowitz.